You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. Real Archaeology Week is a collaborative effort from archaeologists to fill the internet with content demonstrating professional archaeology. The movement aims to combat the flood of pseudo-archaeology from programs such as Netflix's Ancient Apocalypse. Here's Chelsea Rose.
You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today, we're excited to be participating in Real Archaeology, an international effort to flood the airwaves and internet with factual content about archaeology and heritage. We've spoken on the show before about the rising threat of pseudo-archaeology and super slick TV shows that promote long debunked and problematic content, and today we're going to dig a little bit deeper with one of the archaeologists on the front lines of this battle, Dr. Flint Dibble. Not all heroes wear capes, in fact, some wield trowels. Flint, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, and it's good to meet you in this way, Chelsea.
Yeah, great to talk, finally, together. So let's start off with how you found yourself at the center of this, like, hornet's nest. And you are really putting yourself out there. You've publicly debated Graham Hancock, who's behind the new Netflix show in season two, Ancient Apocalypse, on the Joe Rogan show. You're always talking about pseudo-archaeology, and you are brave, and you're just going right to where this conversation is the hottest. So that takes guts. How did you get there? Because you're a zooarchaeologist in your real job, right?
Yeah, so I'm a zooarchaeologist, and I focus on the ancient Greek world, actually. So I do archaeological science and ancient history. And part of that's why I'm doing this as well, that blend of ancient history and archaeological science. And so, you know, I always shared my research on Twitter, as it used to be called back in the day. And I would write these little threads about some research into, like, dogs or something like that, something fun. And you know, you start to see these engagements with people that are fans of pseudo-archaeology, and you always get these questions, well, what could there have been a lost civilization? Or is the Sphinx older than we think it is?
Or the giants. The giants always come up.
Yeah. Did the giants exist? Are they hidden in the Smithsonian?
Yeah, exactly.
Or et cetera. These kind of various things. And, you know, the one that especially I noticed after, you know, I started on Twitter in 2018, and within a few years, it started becoming always about lost civilizations. That was the most common question that people saw as believable. And so that's what I guess first piqued my interest. So I started researching a little bit of the Atlantis story because I kept getting questions about Atlantis. And it was but I didn't really get involved too much in the conversation until Graham Hancock's first season of Ancient Apocalypse came out. And I don't know, Netflix recommended it to me, and I sat down with my partner, Yoni, and we put it on just to see what it was about. And within the first 5 minutes, it's a string of insults towards archaeologists that were censoring him and that were all arrogant and patronizing and were trying to hide the past. And I just thought to myself, what the heck is this? This guy's just declaring war on our field in reality. And so I wrote a Twitter thread that went very viral, sort of critiquing the evidence and the underpinnings of the evidence. That led to an invitation to publish a piece in The Conversation UK, which was called Graham Hancock Declares War on Archaeology. And then the next thing I know, Graham Hancock is declaring, is asking for an archaeologist to debate him on Joe Rogan. And he started calling certain members of our field cowards.
Crickets from the rest of us. You're the only one that answered that call.
Well, sort of. That's not quite true. Dr. David Miano, who has a great YouTube channel on antiquity, he's an ancient historian. He was willing to do so. And so I was willing to do so. We were the two that I think volunteered. And then I think Graham chose me because I was an archaeologist. That was my background. But he really wanted to debate this other archaeologist, Professor John Hoops of Kansas. Mm-hmm. And it was just this milieu of he's challenging our field from a place of not having much evidence. And it was really, to me, it was sort of thinking through, how do you counter this? And I came up with how I thought I would counter it, and that's what I presented on Joe Rogan, where in a sense, he has this sleight of hand where it's about this lost civilization from the Ice Age, but he ignores all of our evidence from the Ice Age and instead focuses on things like pyramids and the Sphinx and monuments that date much later. And so I realized, you know, the real counter to that is to share with people the evidence from the Ice Age. And I talked to some of my, the reason why I'm reasonable for this is I'm a historical archaeologist and archaeological scientist, but my dad was an Ice Age archaeologist. So I'm familiar with both of those pieces of archaeology, which, you know, we all have our different subspecializations. And so I was familiar with the stuff that related to that conversation. And I thought, look, I can share this Ice Age evidence. I can share the evidence for the development of agriculture and how this really disproves the existence of such a lost civilization.
And you really get at some of the what I watched a couple episodes last night to kind of prepare for this of the new series that's about the Americas. And one of the things that struck me right away is he starts off his literally his intro is like, archaeologists are being mean to me and they are unfairly debunking this because, quote, if there was a, this is what he says, we're saying as archaeologists, if there was a lost mm-hmm. civilization, we would have already found it. And that really highlights to me that he's not listening to archaeologists, not only our data, but we're, you know, what we're saying is that our field is not about discovering lost civilizations. And his mm-hmm. framing of that in and of itself is part of the critique that, you know, that he's stalled in this antiquated colonial framework that most archaeologists have long since moved on from. So he's not even the conversation. It's got to be so frustrating for you because it's not just like you're debating facts and nuance. It's like you're talking apples and oranges.
Yeah, he has this idea that there's this linear trajectory to civilization, right? Where it goes from simple to complex. And that is such an outdated idea. And he says he frames it in like, the archaeologists say that there's this linear thing of simple to advanced. Well, maybe they're wrong, and it's actually a cyclical way of looking at it. There's this advanced society that collapses, and then it gets simple, and then there's a reset, and eventually we get back to advanced. And it's just sort of like, look, we don't subscribe to this linear trajectory to civilization. We don't even use the term civilization anymore, really. And so it's just a very outmoded way of thinking about the past, and it draws upon really outdated ideas from the 19th century. A lot of the narrative he puts together is very much just replicates sort of 19th century narratives of a pre-biblical flood version of Atlantis that was told by Ignatius Donnelly in the late 1880s or early 1880s, and then repeated by several others. And so it very much draws upon a really, really old school narrative and a misrepresentation of what our field actually does today.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today I'm speaking with archaeology hero, Dr. Flint Dibble, as part of an international blitz to promote real archaeology. So after season one of Ancient Apocalypse aired, there was a big kerfuffle in the archaeological community because, you know, we are being attacked. And it led to a letter sent by the Society of American Archaeology to Netflix. And they asked within it for the platform to reframe the show as fiction, you know, better label it for what it is, among other things. But also that led to a panel at a conference that both of us were on. And the conversation and surrounding activism has continued to grow. So what is the landscape like as this show is dropping and folks like you are not totally taken off guard by like, oh my gosh, you know, what is happening right now? People have been preparing and responding and kind of in, whether it's a productive dialogue or not, there is some kind of dialogue happening between, you know, the archaeological community or, quote, big archaeology, as Hancock would say, and the general public. So what, you know, where do you think that this show is hitting now compared to the last season?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It only came out about a week ago. I saw that Graham Hancock made a post saying that it was in the top 10 on Netflix in 20 or maybe 30 countries. I can't remember. So it's clearly fairly successful is how I'd frame it. And I wonder if some of that success is because he had a conversation with Keanu Reeves so they could use that in the promotional material. And, you know, as the little thumbnail on Netflix and stuff like that, it's literally a 2-minute conversation that's clipped across 4 different episodes or something like that. And so it's just there to promote the show. But of course, everybody loves Keanu Reeves. He's the internet's boyfriend. And I think that he's a perfect microcosm of the issues we have societally with challenging misinformation. Because, you know, Graham Hancock, despite having zero experience as an archaeologist. He's never excavated, he's never studied artifacts, he's never published an article. He's only been a tourist at archaeological sites. That's his research besides reading books. And so he is presented as legitimate by Amazon.com that sells his books under the archaeology category. He's presented as legitimate by Netflix and IMDb that classify his series as a docuseries. And it makes it very difficult to address the public, because obviously the public can't tell the difference between legitimate real archaeology, like we're trying to promote for this Real Archaeology Festival at real-archaeology.com, but versus this kind of pseudo-archaeology where the hero of the story promotes himself as being against the field of archaeology, and he's the one who has secret knowledge that's overturning the paradigm of history. And so it becomes very difficult for the public to judge the difference when Netflix and Amazon are promoting this stuff as factual when it's not.
Yeah, and that he even frames, I was wondering, because I saw a couple episodes and Keanu Reeves was like in there for like 30 seconds, but he kind of frames like he was brave enough to join me on the show against the archaeology zealots that are like attacking me. And some of this language is really, you know, he's tapping into this larger like tensions about fake news and big media. And like I said, we're the big archaeologists. But, you know, anytime someone feels their opinions are challenged, not reflected, and this, it's hard for people to, like, you know, filter through this stuff now, but there's some real dangers in this, because pseudo-archaeology has a long and dark legacy, like Hitler and the Nazi Party were, you know, kind of cherry-picking data to create a fantasy past, and many of the tenets of this, like, antiquated dialogues or, you know, like, storylines they're tapping into are really rooted in these ideas of white supremacy, which negate indigenous knowledge. And so you want to talk a little bit about how, you know, some people might be like, ah, whatever, the archaeologists are mad. But it's like, no, there's really some problems here in the main, you know, way people think about this stuff getting off course this far.
Yeah, I mean, the history of these ideas of an advanced lost civilization that either is framed as pre-biblical flood or in the Ice Age, as it's phrased from the 20th century onwards, it has a real serious history filled with colonialism and racism. So some of the sources that Hancock uses, and I've called him out on this, they were written by Spanish colonists, like colonizers, who warped indigenous mythology. So this trope that exists of a white savior deity that shows up and gives civilization to indigenous people, that's a very common trope written down by colonizers rather than by indigenous people. And we can compare that to, you know, pre-contact manuscripts. We still have some from the Aztecs and the Maya that depict Quetzalcoatl as not with white skin, but with darker skin. And so, you know, this is clearly a warping of the evidence, and it was used to justify some tremendous evils in the, you know, in the last few hundred years. I mean, in the U.S., for example, the Trail of Tears that we all learned about, where tens of thousands of indigenous people were displaced and kicked out of their homes, when President Andrew Jackson and the legislation, it actually references an earlier civilization that was responsible for the large Native American mounds in the eastern U.S., not giving credit for those mounds to the indigenous people that they were displacing. And it was therefore used to as justification to say they should be removed. They have no connection to the land. And so it has real serious repercussions. And we know today that various conspiracy theory groups and Aryans and neo-Nazis even, and white overt ones, Stephanie Holmhofer, a PhD student at University of Alberta, just recently published a chapter discussing some of these misappropriations of this historical, pseudo-historical trope by modern white supremacy groups. So this is in no way meant to say that everybody who believes in Atlantis or a lost civilization is a racist. I don't think that at all. I certainly don't necessarily think that of Graham Hancock either. But it is a trope that is still pervasive in our world today and carries a lot of harm. At the same time, the promotion of sort of conspiracy cultures, you mentioned that kind of stigmatized language, they're canceling me, big archaeology, things like that. This is very part and parcel with conspiracy culture, not just pseudo-archaeology, but anti-vaccines, climate denialism. And you can see this overlap among many pseudo-archaeology enthusiasts. I don't want to say everybody, but certainly it's part and parcel of the same kind of culture in our weirdly culture wars world.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to take a quick break and we will be back with more Underground History. And we're back. You're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose speaking with Flint Dibble about promoting real archaeology in a post-truth era. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how this idea that archaeologists refuse to embrace new ideas, because in our lifetime as archaeologists, you know, there's been major paradigm shifts because we've, you know, moved past the Clovis first shifts. I went to the University of Oregon. They were real central to that with a lot of the work in Eastern Oregon and Paisley Caves and, you know, really definitively proving that folks were in Oregon before the ice-free corridor, I think 12, 13,000 years ago. But I remember way back in 2008 when I was working with PBS on Time Team, we were at Topper in, I think it was North Carolina, and it was a site that was a Paleo-Indian quarry, and there was another component that was believed to be much older at the time, and I think that they were saying 50,000 years old, which is, you know, a whole wow. other thing. But I remember when we were filming the crew that I was with, we weren't necessarily convinced, but and I don't know what has happened with that site. But one of the things that in watching the episodes last night is they were talking about the Younger Dryas event. And I remember that we were like working with someone there who was trying to collect nanodiamonds that were from the comet. And that I haven't kept up with any of that because I'm a historical archaeologist in the Pacific Northwest. But the Younger Dryas comet and the impact on, you know, human life, that's also been kind of debunked or reframed, right?
Yeah, from what I've read, last year I think it was a very comprehensive refutation of it came out by led by Vance Halliday and a series of other archaeologists, geologists, climatologists, and other scholars. It even involves some of the scientists that were on some of the early papers proposing the comet. Mm-hmm. And so as far as I can gather, there are not many actual scientists who still support the idea of there being an impact that sparked the Younger Dryas. At this point, it strikes me as mostly refuted and no longer believed by almost anybody except for pseudoscientists. I could be wrong. Maybe there's a couple legitimate scientists that are still holding out. As far as I know, most believe that it's refuted.
And that's part of the trouble of like these folks that are cherry picking data, because maybe something came out that was peer reviewed, but it's since been debunked. But if you only use the data you want that reinforces your hypothesis, then you can have this veneer of legitimacy, which really doesn't stand up to critical, you know, examination. And that's kind of part of, I think, what makes these, you know, his argument so slick, is he pulls in just enough stuff that seems legit to folks that haven't been keeping up with the literature.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on. I think it's this cherry picking in a sense, picking out a few facts here, a few facts there. Some have been debunked, some are real, but they're recontextualized. And, you know, I found this one passage in one of Graham's books where he's trying to prove that these hieroglyphic inscriptions at an ancient Greek temple in Egypt were evidence that there's the Atlantis story in Egypt from like 10,000 years ago. And what he does is it's extremely disingenuous. A, he claims he's quoting from these Edfu texts, that's what they're called, and he's not. He's actually quoting from a scholar who is paraphrasing them and summarizing them. B, he puts together these block quotes where one sentence, I'd have to look up the specific page numbers, but the first sentence is from page like 274, and then the next sentence is from page 193, and then the next sentence is from page 76. And so it's like he's just creating his own story by putting together random sentences from different pages spread out 100 pages. And it's like, you know, you have to track down these footnotes to see where they're coming from. And that's, I would say, is largely the methods that so many pseudo scholars use, you know, pseudoscientists use. Is they take this cherry pick thing, and in particular, you talked about this updating and the look, science and archaeology and history. They're very dynamic fields. They're always changing and updating based on different arguments, different pieces of evidence, different methods. And so it's not like just having something peer reviewed means that it's like absolute fact. Consensus is built by all of us just in an organic way, and it doesn't recognize that sort of dynamic nature of scholarship.
Yeah, we know better, we try to do better. And, you know, we could spend the whole interview breaking down all the ways in which this show is problematic, but I know other folks are doing that. So for people who want to do more like an episode by episode breakdown, I know last season we spoke with Carl Fagans and he did like an episode by episode breakdown. I don't know if he's doing that again, but I'm sure others are. But, you know, again, when we think about this higher level stuff, not everybody is going to really go through all the footnotes to see where the things break down. So what are some of the red flags that you think that the listeners who want to be informed and engaged can keep an eye out for to think like, oh, I might want to think critically about this, or I might want to do my own research? You know, are there things like that that people can try to make sure they're accurately consuming content, not just Ancient Apocalypse, but other shows like it?
To be honest, I actually think it's really tough. I think in our world with AI and graphics as we have them and production teams that are willing to be misleading, I really think that shows the value of expertise. And in my hope is that we've seen this pendulum shift of in our culture where people are being enamored by sort of fake histories and fake news and pseudoscience. I'm hoping that maybe with the way that it's flooded the internet and our TVs and our radios, that we're starting to realize we need to go to experts. So I think that's one really important thing. Go to experts, check out what they're saying. There are certainly some red flags that you can think about, though, when you're watching archaeology programming that could sort of highlight that this is an issue. One of them is what a fancy word we call hyperdiffusionism. But really boiled down, what it is it's where the presenter on the slick TV show says, this thing looks like that thing. And those two things are separated by continents and thousands of years in how archaeologists have traditionally dated them using a variety of different robust sources like radiocarbon or textual evidence or whatnot. And so this game of this thing looks like that thing is used throughout. Graham, for example, compares the Moai on Easter Island to statues half the world away, when in fact you could just compare them to local Polynesian statues that are well dated to only about 1,000 or less years ago. So we know that they match the cultural milieu within the local region, but he's going and comparing them to images from Göbekli Tepe from 10,000 years ago. And that's the this thing looks like that thing. That's a real poor way to make an argument within archaeology. We now realize that it's far more complex in how we need to make an argument. The second red flag that shows up in all these kind of pseudo-archaeology shows is, well, the traditional narrative says that the ancestors of this group of people in the Americas or Africa or Asia, they were responsible for it. But actually, maybe it was somebody else, someone hidden that you don't want to know about. It could be a lost civilization. It could be aliens. It could be lizard people. And as soon as you start trying to take credit away from a group of people, that should be a red flag. Hey, why are you taking credit away from the ancestors of people that still live in this region? That does not make any sense. That's not how history or even our understanding of populations and genetics works. We understand that humans are all fairly closely related to one another. It's not like one group fully replaces another group, right? Yeah. What we see is that humanity is far more diverse and complex and related to one another. And so taking credit away from a group, that's what I would call the second large red flag. And then just the idea that they're being canceled or censored or suppressed. If you have evidence, present it in a peer-reviewed source. If I actually thought Atlantis was real, I would publish it and become extremely famous. Instead, I am going to publish my evidence for Atlantis. I'm working on a book on it, but what I'm going to show most likely, my research isn't done, but it'll probably show that it never existed, never could exist. It was a noble lie created by Plato.
But you might not know that here in Oregon, we're right by Mount Shasta, which I think has a gateway to Atlantis. So maybe there's a new chapter. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange, where we explore little known aspects of history in our region and beyond. And today I'm talking about real archaeology under threat and what folks around the world are doing about it. So I want to kind of shift in the last part of our conversation to what people are kind of doing about it. I had heard, and maybe this is a rumor, that during season 2 filming of Ancient Apocalypse, they wanted to do some filming in Chaco Canyon, and there was some opposition from indigenous communities and scholars, and they were able to get the Park Service, I think it was, to pull the permits. And I was wondering if you have been hearing about or seeing any more of that kind of like advocacy to protect these sites from being used, manipulated, and used in these ways?
Yeah, so Sapiens actually had the online magazine, anthropology magazine, Sapiens had an article and an interview with a Hopi elder, I think. The interview came out a couple months ago. But yeah, so I guess there's been more outcry from local indigenous communities about the fact that their history is being presented in this fictitious way that strips credit from their ancestors. And so there's been more outcries. I think there actually was still some footage from Chaco Canyon in season two, though I could be wrong. So it was after, in between two different sets of filming, mm-hmm. that some of that happened. And I guess the team chose not to film anymore in the U.S. after that. So there has been more activism led largely by indigenous communities rather than by archaeologists. And so I fully support and think that that's the way forward. It should be up to these stakeholders, the people whose descendants lived in these areas, to decide how their history is told. Same with how their history should be studied by scholars like us. And so I think that that's extremely valuable, and it's a good first step in many ways so that they can get some more agency back in how they control their past. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that I want to kind of build on that, and then also what you mentioned earlier about, you know, one of the best ways to combat pseudo-archaeology and misinformation is to go to the experts. So indigenous communities, and also, you know, this festival that you built, Real to Archaeology, is pulling together folks from around the world that have expertise and have been using their various platforms. I think there's, you know, we're on the radio, but there's also TikTok and YouTube and all these different ways people are communicating with their audiences and building trust, and hopefully that's helping to get the word out there. So I wanted to see if you wanted to speak a little bit about that, and also what audiences we might not be reaching, because I know that you've had quite violent kind of reactions to some of the work that you've been talking about. So where are the people that we're reaching, and where are the people that we could make a difference to, but that we're maybe not tapping into yet?
Yeah, no, this is really good. I mean, I think as sort of educators and scholars, we should be trying to reach everybody. And I certainly think that archaeology does a pretty good job of reaching children. You know, we have all sorts of wonderful events at museums and sites that parents bring their kids to. And that's all over the world. We're really good at creating content for children. I think we're less good at creating content for adults, and in particular for adults that don't have an advanced degree or a college degree. I think that that's a real challenge to hit that kind of market. And so I think to a certain degree, we need to start talking to audiences that we're not as accustomed to talking to. And we need to think through how we go about doing that. And in some ways, I think that sort of challenging the status quo of pseudoscience by actually debating it, let's say, on Joe Rogan, is effective. It creates a situation where there's drama around it that people are interested in, and therefore gives me and others an opportunity to actually present the accurate details about people in the end of the Ice Age or about the development of agriculture. And by actually explaining things, and with adults, you don't want to dumb things down, right? Even adults that don't have a college education, we should never be dumbing things down. People want the details of what we do, and so we don't simplify, we make them understandable. And so that's always my goal when I try to talk with adults about our field and how we do it. I really want to present an accurate and up-to-date, cutting-edge way of describing it without all the jargon and the big fancy words to get the point across. And so I think the real goal is we shouldn't just be debunking. We need to really share the reality of our field. So much scholarship into how to combat misinformation suggests that the key thing is to pre-bunk it. And what that really means is teach people the reality, right? That's all that means, is teach people the reality. And so that's what this event is, Real Archaeology, real-archaeology.com, is to bring together sort of YouTubers, podcasters, TikTokers, bloggers, really anybody. I think we have Twitter threads participating, live streamers participating all around the world. I don't know how many countries we have represented, maybe almost 10. And so to really bring us all together and to sort of say, hey, you've all heard that the internet is filled with fake archaeology, and we know that it is. But there's also a lot of really good real archaeology content. Some of it is created by scholars and professionals. Others of it is created by amateurs and enthusiasts. But what we all believe in is a shared commitment to facts and evidence and the actual narratives created by people on the ground, the archaeologists that are doing the work, and their collaborations with local stakeholder communities, whether it's indigenous people in the U.S. or Greek people in Greece that I work with. The point is that we're working together to create these narratives.
And that is the perfect pitch to end on. So be sure and head over to Real Archaeology to see all the different things going on. You can find many more conversations like this one. And thank you so much, Flint, for joining us on the show. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. And you can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.